Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, this evening our special guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we'll be with Dr. Cuddy in just a moment. I wanted to point out that this last week, the House of Representatives, our Congress, had passed three decisive pieces of legislation. First of all, they made it illegal to dig a tunnel under the border of the United States, either a tunnel into Canada or Mexico. Now, isn't that an exciting thing to know, that they've outlawed digging tunnels under the border by which things can be smuggled in? And then the second piece of legislation was it's all right. In fact, the government has the right to deport people who are parts of illegal gangs here in the United States, as long as they're illegally here. In other words, if they are here illegally, why members of violent gangs can be deported. You might think that people who are here illegally might be deported anyway, but no, if you're a member of a violent gang and you're here illegally, then we can deport you. And then thirdly, they're going to build a 700-mile fence, but they've been passed that over and over again. They just sort of never get around to doing anything. And they're giving the American people the idea that they're really going to do something about illegal immigration, whereas they have no intention of doing anything about it. But we've got to make the people think we're going to do something about it, because elections are coming up, and of course they're doing everything to keep us happy, keeping the stock market up, the dropping the price of oil. And if you don't think this is manipulated, you just wait till after the elections and see what happens to the price of oil. And then, of course, they have now found that over half of the over 71,000 people who worked on the debris of the World Trade Center in New York City have serious pulmonary problems, and many of them, of course, have lost tremendous lung capacity and have got to the point where they can just barely get by. Many of them have to give up their jobs as firemen. And the thing is that the New York authorities knew that the air was toxic, and Kristen Todd Whitman has said, well, we knew it was toxic. We keep telling them that. But nobody at the, who was working there at the pile knew that, and they were ordered to wear their respirators, and a lot of them were there without respirators, and they'll never be the same again. How could you handle anything that poorly unintentionally? And maybe, is it possible that there really are people who are unconcerned about the health of the people who are working there? Is it possible that they could have possibly intentionally allowed that to happen? Is it possible that they're doing things to the American people and even to our children that will destroy their minds and their health? Well, with that as a background, let's get to our special guest this evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Dr. Cuddy writes regularly for newswithviews.com, and you can get his articles there. Certainly he taught at the college level. He worked in the Department of Education under the Reagan administration. He's testified before Congress, but he certainly is one of the finest researchers we have, and of course we've carried his books. We carry all those in print, and we're working to get another one of his books back in print. And we hope that you'll want to help us with that. But without further ado, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, thanks so very much for being with us, Dennis. Dennis, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
You certainly can. You go right ahead.
Well, I'm really glad to hear about those illegal tunnels now being illegal.
Right. That Congress does so many good things for the American people. We should be so proud of them.
Seeing as how they don't seem to follow through on any of the other illegal activities of the immigrants here, I don't guess that this tunnel is going to be any big obstacle either.
No, we're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. You go right ahead, Dennis.
Sure. There's something in the news today that's relevant to This past week was the fifth anniversary of 9/11 attack, and there'll be a show coming up in a couple of days, this Sunday, 60 Minutes. There was an interview that was taped. It's getting some press and the Associated Press today and yesterday as well, where the Pakistani president, Musharraf, is being interviewed, and in this interview he says that after the attack of 9/11, the then Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage told the Pakistani Intelligence Director of the United States, the words he said was, be prepared to go back to the Stone Age if the Pakistanis didn't cooperate with us. Now, Armitage, I've written about before in my News with Views column. He has a really interesting past, but the point is, Armitage, according to this, and it doesn't say the name of the person he talked to, but your listeners, if they've heard me before, know who this Pakistani intelligence director is. It's that General Mahmoud Ahmad, and he met with Armitage at least after 9/11, maybe before, but for sure after 9/11. And what's interesting is Armitage is saying, well, I don't remember that. I know I spoke in rough terms, and everybody will remember the message that they were telling everybody was, you're either with us or against us. And, of course, the Taliban was against us, and look what happened to the Taliban. They got bombed back to the Stone Age. So even though Armitage may be denying that he used the term prepared to go back to the Stone Age, it seems fairly clear, given what our policy was towards the Taliban in Afghanistan, what that meant, whether he used the term Stone Age or bombed back to the Stone Age or not.
So it wasn't really basically a threat to President Musharraf that you either go along with us or we'll bomb Pakistan back into the Stone Age. You join the war on terror or else.
That's right. And what's interesting, as I said, because they don't give the fellow's name, but the person he's talking to is that General Mahmoud Ahmad. And so for your listeners who are either not familiar with my columns or haven't heard me on this subject before, since last week was the anniversary of 9/11, well, I thought I'd do it at first, and we can get on to something else if time allows. But at first, I want to just go back to that mini-series that they had last week, ABC's mini-series, The Path to 9/11.
All right, fine. You just hang on there. I just want to wait until we bring all of our stations back on with us, and they'll be coming on here just in a moment as we begin analyzing 9/11. Well, our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and he's talking about a mini-series that was on this last week about the path to 9/11. And why don't you pick the story up there, Dennis?
Sure. Your listeners, as I said, this Sunday you'll see a 60 Minutes interview with President Musharraf of Pakistan talking about what his intelligence chief, it's the ISI, is the acronym for the term for the Pakistani intelligence agency, had told him about Richard Armitage saying bomb back to the Stone Age. The AP interview, column that's mentioning this, doesn't mention the name of the fellow, but it's General Mahmoud Ahmad. So if any of your listeners haven't read my columns, they may want to think about how this all connects and why this interview Sunday is relevant to what's happened in the past, because there's a lot of things in that ABC miniseries, The Path to 9/11, that were not revealed. It was a pretty, you know, standard format relying on the testimony of the 9/11 Commission and some other sources, and there was a controversy, and Clinton objected to it. But, for example, the path to 9/11 didn't say that there was a June 2001 Reuters report, that it was really a race between the U.S. and Osama bin Laden as to who would attack first. It also didn't reveal that the very next month, July 2001, there's a backgrounder by Bill Gertz. It appeared on a number of places, including the Northwest Airlines flight attendants website. So it wasn't, you know, anything top secret. And that item that he had, the backgrounder, was talking about the Al-Qaeda plot, Project Bojinka, to hijack airliners and fly them specifically into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and some other places. The miniseries also didn't reveal that after President Bush was briefed on August 6, 2001, that al-Qaeda wanted to strike inside the U.S., the attacks of 9/11 on the World Trade Center were easily preventable. And I've mentioned this previously, but briefly, it's a very simple matter that any child interested in simple common sense could have figured out. If you think there's going to be attack, where will they attack? Well, they tried to bomb the World Trade Center. They did bomb the World Trade Center, the terrorists, back in 93, so that would be a logical target. And so it's simply a matter of contingency planning to say, what if they tried to attack it again? Truck bomb, sarin gas, or airplane, some type of air attack. You don't even have to know what kind of air attack.
Well, of course, we have the Bill Gates backgrounder, and I'll send any of our listeners, if they'd like, a copy of that. We actually have that that was pulled out on September 11th, you know, the very day of the attack. Amazingly enough, it suddenly disappeared from the Internet immediately after that. But in that, they were talking about hijacking the planes and specifically crashing them into the World Trade Center. So, you know, if it was up on the Internet for the Northwest Airlines flight attendants, you would think that the government might be smart enough to know exactly what all the flight attendants knew, and that is that they were planning on hijacking planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center. But, you know, Condoleezza Rice said, gee, who would ever have thought that they'd hijack planes and crash them into buildings? And yet, of course, they'd actually talked about something very similar, hijacking planes and using them, as I believe, as weapons, you know, in the PDD. Furthermore, if you read the new book, and it's put out by Thomas Keene and Lee Hamilton, the co-chairman of the 911 Commission, the book is called Without Precedent, and it says there that the FAA knew there was a plan to hijack planes and use them as weapons. So, you know, you would think that maybe they might have thought, well, if this is a factor, maybe we ought to do something to prevent it, is the point you're making, isn't it?
Yes. There were a number of federal reports, one back in 1999, talking about al-Qaeda's martyrdom battalion could hijack planes and fly them into these edifices. So it was around. The reason President Bush got the presidential daily briefing, the PDB, on August 6th was exactly because of that. George Tenet was running around saying, we're going to be attacked, we're going to be attacked, and so on. As CIA director, they thought it most likely that it would be overseas, but still, the title of that August 6th briefing was that bin Laden determined to strike inside the U.S. So it was at least a possibility, and as I said, just common sense, even for a child, elementary school child, would be, well, you know, what if the bad men try to attack the big building? How might we prevent it? And, of course, you don't even have to know. Now, that's one of the things that bothered me about Condoleezza Rice and the press allowing her. She kept saying, well, there was no actionable intelligence. It's as though the terrorists literally have to call her up. And remember, she took this job as National Security Advisor, the person in charge of our security, which she didn't have to do, but she did. And she has all these aides around. You would have thought somebody would say, well, let's see, they tried to bomb this thing, and they did bomb it in 93. What if they attack by air? The actionable intelligence almost means somebody has to call them and say, okay, listen, Condi, next Tuesday, 5 o'clock, truck bomb the corner of 5th and Main. What does she need to sit down and develop some sort of contingency plan so she gets it wrong? You know, so it's in Des Moines at a pickle stand. I mean, whatever. At least you should have some sort of contingency plan for an attack on the World Trade Center, because they already tried to bomb and say, we're going to do it, you know, next time we'll get it right and all that. So you don't even have to know what kind of air attack it would be. You would simply have an Apache Longbow helicopter, military helicopter, that doesn't have to be right by the building, doesn't have to be in the air all the time. New York has at least three forts, Fort Hamilton and a couple of others, could have it on standby alert. You know, they knew the attack would be soon, so it's not like it's going to gather, you know, moss sitting there on the ground somewhere. And it has 30-millimeter chain gun. It has rockets. It has missiles. Just pick up the phone. You know, up goes the copter, and it could have easily prevented that. But the point is, this series didn't get into any of that. However, relevant to this General Mahmoud Ahmad, that's what was probably the most important thing missing from this miniseries. And so, regarding that fellow, and remember, he's the one that Musharraf will be talking about if you see this on this coming Sunday. In June 2001, there was a 31-month federal probe called, it ended then, it was called Operation Diamondback. And what happened was it ended with the arrest, after 31 months, of two arms brokers working for Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, who were caught finalizing a deal to sell missiles, nuclear components, and other weaponry to terrorists linked to Osama bin Laden. That was about the same time, June 2001, that this fellow, the ISI chief, General Mahmoud Ahmad, visited the U.S. This is the first time. I'm going to mention, he'd been here before, but this is the first of two times I'm going to mention. All right, around June 2001. Actually, it was there was a sting operation during this 31-month period and caught on tape on July 14th of 1999, part of this operation. And it was a trendy New York City grill called the Tribeca Grill. And they were meeting there. And there were some FBI guys, you know, planted around at the tables and so on. And it was during this probe that you had a Pakistani operative named R.G. Abbas, A-B-B-A-S. He worked for the ISI, Pakistani Intelligence, and the Taliban. And as he was leaving the grill with the fellows who were involved there, he pointed to the World Trade Center and said, "Those towers are coming down," end quote. Now, that's on tape. All right, the FBI has that on tape. One of their main informants who was there, there were several. Actually, he's the main one. There was another ATF guy, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms guy. It was Randy Glass. Now, on August 6, 2001, this is the same day as the presidential daily briefing, he tells the South Florida Sun Sentinel that he was with Abbas at the grill because Randy Glass, quote, was told by federal agents that the case had become a matter of national security with potentially thousands of lives at risk, end quote. Remember that, thousands of lives at risk. 1999, FBI probe, Operation Diamondback. Okay, the ISI, Pakistani intelligence, actually created bin Laden's protector, the Taliban, in Afghanistan. And not long after General Ahmad's visit to the U.S., June 2001, that same general had $100,000 wired to 9/11 ringleader Mohammed Atta.
But Dennis, doesn't the ISI, Pakistani intelligence, work very closely with the American CIA?
All of our operations in that part of the world, almost all, 90-some percent, go through the ISI. Pakistani intelligence. If we want to do something, for years in Afghanistan, wherever it is, it would go through the ISI. We get the okie dokie on who's in charge of the ISI. We don't like somebody, they're gone, as Mahmoud Ahmad found shortly after 9/11. But they're almost a product of the U.S. They are Pakistanis, but very, very, very closely. And Armitage works very, 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 very closely with these people. He got an award, a medal, from the government about this stuff. Okay. Now, all right, so he tells them this, and the ISI created bin Laden's protector, the Taliban. So not long after that visit, the June 2001 visit by General Ahmad, the general has the $100,000 wired to Mohammed Atta. Then shortly after that, he returns to the U.S. on September 4, 2001. Just a week before 9/11, and he comes back, he's just been here 3 months ago, so he's back now for a couple of weeks. He's talking to everybody. On the morning of 9/11, he's talking with Senator Bob Graham, whose office he warned in advance that the World Trade Center would be under attack, in Porter Goss, and we'll continue after the break.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's so important, and of course, some of that story is told in Senator Robert Graham's book, as I recall, but of course the average American doesn't have time to begin to connect all of the dots. The government knew that there was going to be an attack, and they knew it was going to be on the World Trade Center. How do we know that? This was what Operation Pachinko was all about. It was brought up in the original 911 investigation and deleted from the final report by somebody so the American people would never know. Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, so What we have is this general, Ahmad, returning on September 4th to the U.S. as though he had some new information. And he's going to stay a while. He's just been there about 3 months before, and he's talking to lots of people at the CIA and so on. All right, now, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman was in Brooklyn, the blind sheikh, and he was, you know, to a large extent behind that 1993 World Trade Center bombing. 2 days after General Ahmad arrived on the 4th, September 4th, a high school freshman in Brooklyn who had recently immigrated from Pakistan told his class, a heated discussion, that the World Trade Center, quote, won't be standing there next week. Not the next day, not in 2 weeks, 2 months, whatever, next week.
How could our listeners, of course, this is covered in your book, Cover Up, but you actually tracked that story down to be sure it's correct, didn't you?
Yes, there were actually two. There was the MSNBC, Jonathan Alter at Newsweek, and then there was some other local story in the Journal News by a fellow named Jeffrey Scott Shapiro up in it's Putnam County and Westchester County and so forth, locally up in New York, yes.
Okay, go ahead. So basically, this child gets up in the classroom there in New York and said, those twin towers will not be there, or those towers will not be there a week from now, and this was just about a week before 9/11. So certainly the children knew about it. You wonder why our government says they had no idea.
Right. This is on September 6th, and of course, on the 11th, you have the attack, and a lot of the youngsters just, quote, you know, happened to bring their cameras there that day on the 11th to take pictures of the event. Okay, moving on up to September 13th, a couple of days after the attack. 2 days after the school's closed, this new Utrecht, they say, high school in Brooklyn, and the school's closed the next day, but the following day, the 13th, it's open. And here come the federal agents. And they interview this boy and his brother, whose father was returning that day, the 13th, from Pakistan. The father gets there, and he's chastising these federal agents for, quote, harassing his children. And shortly after that, he hops on the plane and goes right back to Pakistan. Okay. Now, on September 10th, the day before 9/11, a Pakistani newspaper, now remember, this is the 10th, they're not responding to an event or anything, this is on the 10th, it's called The News, it reported that this General Ahmad's, quote, this is in the Pakistani paper, day before 9/11, so General Ahmad's, quote, week-long presence in Washington has triggered speculation about the agenda of his mysterious meetings at the Pentagon and National Security Council, end quote, the mysterious meetings. Well, I filed a Freedom of Information request with the Department of Defense and was told there was a document regarding one of the high-level Pentagon officials about whom I had inquired that said, quote, here's information on your upcoming meeting with General Ahmad, end quote. So this is before 9/11, upcoming meeting with Ahmad. On that same day, September 10th, according to Newsweek, the Newsweek column was the online edition of September 13th, and then it was repeated on the 24th. It says there, about September 10, a particularly urgent warning may have been received the night before the attacks. Remember that, the night before, not the day before, the night before. And a group of top Pentagon officials suddenly canceled travel plans.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy has been talking about the General Mahmoud Ahmad, and of course the fact that he had been visiting the week before, just a few days before the 9/11 attack, with people from the Pentagon. And then Dr. Cuddy quotes from an article, which you can find in Newsweek magazine. It was on their internet site on the 13th of September, but it appeared in Newsweek magazine on the 24th of September, right after the attack, saying that, and would you like to tell our listeners what that article in Newsweek said, because it would appear that the people in the Pentagon knew the attack was coming on the 11th. What did that article say?
Well, what's important, before I do that, let me explain that article. Whenever I call up one of these hotshot reporters, they start throwing around conspiracy theories and so forth and so on, and in fact, the Freedom of Information fellow at the Department of Defense he's a nice enough fellow, but he started saying, well, you know, how do you know this, and so on. And I ask him and your listeners to just go through a sort of logical process. If on September 13th, Newsweek prints this story that says, quote, a particularly urgent warning may have been received the night before the attacks, not, you know, 2 days of that morning, the night before the attacks, and a group of top Pentagon officials suddenly canceled travel plans for the next morning, not the next afternoon or, you know, next week, apparently because of security concerns. If they print that on the 13th online, you know somebody at the Pentagon is going to see the thing. And if it's not true, you know, the press secretary or somebody will call up and say, you people don't know what you're talking about, we've checked, it's false, and so on and so on. Now, if I'm the publisher of Newsweek and I get somebody at the Pentagon saying we've messed up, you know, I'll, you know, check and double check and triple check sources and get the legal department in on this and so forth. The point is, before I would print that again in print on the 24th with Evan Thomas, the Washington Bureau Chief's name on it, I would have to have, you know, confirmation all over the place before I reprinted that if the Pentagon had told me I was wrong. So we can be, you know, despite all these conspiracy theory charges thrown up, we can be fairly sure that Newsweek was accurate in that. And so what you have is the Pakistani paper, the news, saying his week-long presence, General Mott's, with these mysterious meetings at the Pentagon and National Security Council. These things really happened, and as I said, the Freedom of Information request did result in a document. They won't let me have it yet. They say it's got to clear this, that, and the other. But at least he told me. He said, here's information on your upcoming meeting with General Ahmad. This is with one of the top Pentagon officials I had been asking about. Okay. So it makes sense, then, what they were saying about suddenly canceling the travel plans for the next morning. All right. That same night, September 10th, remember, it said they may have received word the night before the attacks, the Pentagon people. All right, that same night, not, you know, that morning, 10 o'clock a.m., but that night, San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, who was to fly to New York City the morning of 9/11, he receives a call around 10 p.m. warning him and all Americans, really, about their air travel. And, Dr. Stan, you have that San Francisco column that appeared early, and then that that also was yanked off of the, off of the Internet as well. No longer available about that, but he did say that. And I was on not too long after that a radio interview with Mayor Brown. They wouldn't let me directly talk to him, but we were on the same show. And so the host sort of, you know, said, what do you want to ask him? And so I said, what I want to ask him. And so they asked him, but he never would go beyond, oh, the security people at the airport. He just kept mumbling that. Now, I don't want to accuse him, but let's say that he thought, as a lot of people did, maybe Newsweek thought, that what happened to him, Mayor Brown, was just a routine FAA warning, because Willie Brown said, oh, I've gotten these types of warnings before, you know, watch out for this, that, or the other. And so he probably thought, you know, this was a standard FAA warning that he'd received in the past. What he and I guess most other people didn't bother to do, I know for sure Evan Thomas wouldn't, I tried to get him to, he said, oh, I don't, you know, believe in conspiracy theories and stuff like that. I filed another Freedom of Information request, this time with the FAA. And, you know, I thought, you know, sure, they may have a warning or two, standard procedure, whatever. But I was surprised when they actually informed me they had issued no warnings from September 2 through September 11th. So, you know, this raises the question of where is this warning coming from? Maybe it's the same urgent type warning that these Pentagon people got that night. So here's a theory, and like I said, I'm not saying this is what happened, but I'm saying here's a theory that would not necessarily even involve a conspiracy, and we can continue after the break.
All right, fine. Of course, I personally, for our listeners, I personally called Mayor Willie Brown's press secretary and asked him to verify this story, which he did, and said essentially what Dr. Cuddy has said, that yes, they'd gotten actually a similar warning in June or July, and then they'd gotten this one. And it was just said that Mayor Brown should be very careful of flying the next day. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. We're talking about the fact that somebody knew something was going to happen on the morning of September 11th. And, of course, this is why Mayor Willie Brown was warned the night before the attack, why the people in the Pentagon canceled their flights for the morning of the September 11th on the September the 10th. And I'm sure why the children in the school in New York, Pakistani section of New York, were bringing their cameras to school on the morning of September 11th so they could take pictures of the attack on the World Trade Center. And yet we are to assume that, of course, nobody in government had any idea what was going to occur. What is really interesting, if you actually read the latest book put out by the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission, they will tell you that the members of the military, the generals in charge, you know, who testified before their committee, actually lied to them about the military exercises that were held that morning. They don't mention the military exercises, but they do mention as to the timeline of what happened that morning and why there were no planes guarding either our nation's capital or New York City, and that they were going to think of taking it, charging them with perjury. But instead, of course, they turned it over to the military, and the military investigated and said, oh, no, whatever the general said was true. Well, certainly Thomas Keene and Lee Hamilton thought that they had lied under oath, but of course just got very little play in the general media. So you pick the story up, Dr. Cuddy.
Yes, sir. The thing that bothers me about not only what you said, but a number of other things that just happened back then, whether it's Dale Watson saying, assuring Congress, about 3 years before 9/11, that we're cooperating, we're sharing information, CIA, FBI, and so forth, and then the day after 9/11, or shortly thereafter 9/11, President Bush shows up at the CIA and congratulating all of them. It seems that there is no consequence or responsibility for messing this stuff up. In fact, people, Dale Watson and others, actually get promoted. And so, what kind of signal does that send to individuals who are not really doing all they should, including the translators? There's one woman who still feels that she's under a gag order about the jubilation among some of the Arab-speaking translators there when 9/11 occurred. She said, I think that day or the next day they brought in little tea and crumpets and parties and they were yucking it up.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy, you picked the story right up there. We're talking about the fact that certainly after the 9/11 attack, instead of trying to find out who was responsible for the dereliction of duty, 3,000 Americans are dead, almost 3,000 are dead. Instead of course, going over and raising a ruckus with the CIA, President Bush goes over and congratulates them for a job well done, and the key people there who were responsible for the deaths of the Americans are promoted. That doesn't make sense.
Right, and the FBI as well, this Dale Watson, who was head of counterterrorism at the time, actually gets promoted afterwards, even though back 3 years before 9/11, when he was testifying before Congress, he was assuring them that, yes, we are cooperating, CIA, FBI, we are sharing information. Well, after 9/11, what's one of the main things they said was a problem, even the 9/11 Commission? Well, there was this wall. We couldn't communicate with each other. The CIA should have told the FBI about Al-Hazmi and Al-Matar, but unfortunately they didn't, and so we weren't sharing. And this is after Congress had been assured by this fellow that they were sharing information, and what happens? Well, he gets promoted. He gets a raise in this thing. Same thing with this. The previous comments I made about Randy Glass as an informant. The ATF agent who was also there at the meeting with him undercover, his name was Stoltz. And so they interviewed Stoltz, and then this other fellow who was in charge of counterterrorism within the Clinton administration, in the executive branch, not the FBI, I forget his name, it's like Rex Stetler or whatever. Both of them expressed great surprise that the FBI didn't bump this up because they had a specific threat on tape about an attack on the World Trade Center. And so both of them say, golly, you know, I wonder why the FBI didn't pick up on this and, you know, open this investigation even further and track these people and so forth. In fact, one of them and one of the couple of people there at the meeting even had his charges dismissed after they picked him up later, and his court records were sealed. So, I mean, even today, you can't look in his court records and see what was there. So it's really strange. So anyway, this is a theory. Like I said, I'm not saying this is what happened, but really I'm putting this down sort of as a response to Evan Thomas and this Department of Defense fellow who's the one going through my Freedom of Information request. He still is. He's, you know, giving me some stuff, but not a lot. Let me just mention
for our listeners that Evan Thomas is the publisher of the Newsweek magazine, isn't that right?
I think he may have been promoted to like editor in chief.
He's got a key position at Newsweek, and it was his article on the 24th of September that talked about the Department of Defense officials who canceled their flights for the morning of September 11th on the previous evening. So, but he didn't want to look into this. I mean, Dr. Cuddy, of course, said, you know, we ought to get into it. He just said, I don't want to talk about it. Didn't he want to talk about it or tell you where he got the information? Of course, think of the implications. If the government knew ahead of time, or certainly officials knew ahead of time and let 3,000 Americans die, why, think of the implications and the fact that they were never punished. So you would have to assume if they were not punished, they were doing what they were supposed to do.
Let me clarify what you just said there. There's really two things that happen. My first call was to the fellow who did the September 13th online column, the one who supposedly was responsible for having the sources that verified this. His name was Mark Hosenball. Hosenball, when I asked him if he found out who the top Pentagon officials were, he said no. And then I said, well, did you not ask them, or did you ask them and they refused to tell you? And that's when he said, quote, I don't want to talk about it anymore, end of conversation. So then I picked up the phone and called Evan Thomas, since his name was on the September 24th print edition. And I said, well, you know, Mark Hosenball was just talking about this, and he was really interested. Well, what did he say? And so I said, just what I told you and your listeners. And he started to chuckle a little, you know, ha, 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 like that. And I said, well, you know, this is, I mean, you printed it twice. It's the 24th. Your name's on this one. And he's not going to look into it. And his almost immediate reaction was, well, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. And he said, I guess Congress looked into this and found there was nothing there, and so that's the end of it. You know, I mean, this is no Woodward and Bernstein, right? Have you ever heard of Time or any other reporter saying, oh, well, you know, Congress had this committee look into it. We don't really care. Congress did it, and they're telling us this. And so what the heck, you know, there was no Watergate. It was really rather humorous, except he was insisting on this. Now, you got to remember who Evan Thomas is. He's the grandson of Norman Thomas, the six-time Socialist Party candidate for the presidency. So anyway, this guy is wired. So I told him about Willie Brown. He said, oh, I guess he just heard it, you know, routine call. I said, well, no. And I said, why don't you call him up? Not interested. He really wanted to get off of this as soon as possible, which he did. But anyway, that's when I started, you know, this Freedom of Information request. So anyway, to respond to that type of person, and the Department of Defense fellow who's looking at the Freedom of Information request that I made there, what I'm going to go through is a theory that does not have to be some really bad, negative, evil conspiracy. Now, remember, I'm not saying that's not what happened. I'm just saying you would think that the press would at least be interested in the truth, including the possibility that what I'm about to say happened. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to know this? For example, is it possible the CIA, which works, as you said, Dr. Stan, very closely with the ISI, asked General Ahmad to infiltrate Al-Qaeda? I mean, we say we couldn't. I doubt it. But we say we couldn't. And, of course, the Pakistanis could, because they are, you know, they are literally the creators of the Taliban.
I don't know why we couldn't get into Al-Qaeda, because Johnny Lynn Walker, the fellow from San Rafael up north where I live, was able to get in and meet bin Laden a couple of times. How could he be so much smarter than the entire CIA and the 14 intelligence agency we have? We couldn't infiltrate them, but Johnny Lynn Walker could? Come on now.
Well, don't you also now have this other fellow out there from California? He's sort of dressed in white. He's an American, but he's in Muslim garb. And now isn't he the chief face of Al-Qaeda on Al Jazeera now? They just seem to come out of California for some reason. Yes. So anyway, let's assume, I'm not saying I believe it, let's assume that we asked General Ahmad to have his ISI infiltrate Al-Qaeda. Let's say he did. Let's say part of the, you know, the carrot he was giving to them was this $100,000, you know, try to gain their trust. Is it possible that he learned some things, but not everything? Let's say he learned that there was a non-date-specific attack for the week of 9/11, you know, 9/10 through 9/14, sometime that week. Let's say he learned that it involved hijacked planes, and that's why, after just 3 months, he comes racing back over here to warn us. I mean, you know, that's a question. Is it possible that he warned some of these top Pentagon officials who, the night of September 10th, received confirmation of an impending attack that week, don't know exactly when, that week, and since they had their travel plans the next morning, they said, hey, you know, we better cancel these. And they notified a few others, you know, important officials, Mayor Brown, who was coming to New York. Is it possible that these Pentagon officials would have warned the general public if they knew the specific date? You can see them, you know, sitting around a table, do we tell the public? And they say, well, golly, you know, we should, but what if it's Thursday and we say tomorrow and everybody in the, you know, grandmother will be canceling their hotel reservations and it'll shut down the airline industry for a week, and then what if the, you know, terrorists get wind of it and cancel it, and then we'll look like idiots and the boy who cried wolf and all that sort of stuff. And then somebody else sitting around the table says, well, so what's the hijacking? They want to grab a plane and take it to Cuba or somewhere. We've got standard operating procedures for this. We don't want to create any nationwide panic, and of course they keep their mouths shut, then 9/11 happens. Now those are all questions. Those are all sort of logical. I mean, I'm going to say that's what happened, but you can see these people, you know, going through this stuff. What bothers me, really, is that the press and media, including this Path to 9/11 miniseries, they don't seem the least bit interested in even finding out if that is what happened, or something worse. So what you have to ask yourself, like you say, Dr. Stan, is there really something going on here? Because this press and media, they also haven't seemed interested in finding out why the July 7th, 2005 London bombing ringleader, his name was Harun Rashid Aswad, why he fled, and this is just a year ago, why he fled to Pakistan the day before the bombing, but he was released within 24 hours of his arrest there. Why did that happen? If, you know, General Ahmad gets the boot right after 9/11 and Musharraf is now our buddy, how come just a year before now, 4 years after 9/11, this ringleader of this London bombing, he takes off where? To Belgium? No. India? No. Indonesia? No. He takes off to Pakistan, where Musharraf is the head. The day before that bombing, the day before July 7th, 2005, he's arrested, but in 24 hours, he's free. You just can't believe that sort of thing happens without Musharraf's okie-dokie. And so and apparently the press doesn't care about that either. I mean, Evan Thomas would, you know, say that's a conspiracy also. So, what we have is something very interesting going on here. And, my point in doing that series of questions is, you could say that was logical, that it wasn't some evil conspiracy, but the press isn't even interested in that, finding that out, which means we're in serious trouble if the press isn't even interested in finding out a non-evil conspiracy scenario to this stuff. And so I'm afraid that we're in for some tough times, and who knows? We know that Saddam Hussein was a CIA asset back in the late 50s. We know that Osama bin Laden has been a CIA asset. It may be that Ahmadinejad in Iran is a CIA asset.
Oh, and incidentally, you know where he went on Wednesday after he addressed the United Nations?
Where was that?
Well, he went to the Harold Pratt House, the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations, to meet with the bosses. Pete Peterson was there. All the key people in the Council on Foreign Relations met with President Ahmadinejad on Wednesday of this week. Isn't it interesting that the media didn't mention that?
Well, how about that? I bet they didn't also mention, I can't remember the name of it, Rumsfeld and a bunch of these elitists just went up to Banff, B-A-N-F-F something or other, up in Canada to talk about the North American community and how we're going to all get together with trade relations and all of that. I bet that hadn't appeared in the press either.
Well, there's so very little that the American people do read, and they keep our attention focused on all sorts of unimportant issues, like, of course, the spinach conspiracy.
Yes, or Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
Wag the dog. O.J. Simpson's trial. Yes, all of these distractions so that they don't find out what's going on. But anyway, in the last few minutes, I would encourage your listeners to look at my News with Views column. The last one is about Javier Solana. He's a very important player and the end times. I'm not saying that Javier Solana is the fellow mentioned in 666 and, you know, in the Book of Revelation, but the point is, you have Christ saying that the signs of the end times will be rather apparent, and he gives certain inferences to that regard. And what you want to look at is where Javier Solana is, who he is, his background, that this is an individual who was relatively obscure until some Rhodes scholars, Bill Clinton, Strobe Talbot, and Richard Gardner, who was Clinton's ambassador to Spain, were largely responsible for his appointment, Solana's appointment as head of NATO in 1995. He's now an extremely powerful individual as the Secretary General of both the Council of the European Union and Western European Union. And remember, if you're into eschatology, the Western European Union has 10 nations. Remember the 10 kings. And Constance Cumby has done a lot of work on this. She keeps up with Solana almost every day, and she has followed his trail, and it looks like part of Cecil Rhodes' plan is coming to the fore to take the government of the whole world, that Solana plays a key role in what the term is integration, global integration. Solana has been very much involved in European integration. We hear this sort of language in our own hemisphere with this North American Union as planned about the North American integration of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. The year 2010 seems to be when this North American Union, this integration, is to come into existence. And it may have, according to the Fraser Institute up in Canada, which I think began this back in 1995, a new currency called the Amero. I don't think it'll replace the dollar immediately. It'll be more like the euro. You still have the lira and the pound and so forth there, but international transactions go to the euro. This will be pretty much, I think, what happens here. You'll still have the dollar, but the dollar will become even more greatly devalued, and so a lot of international transactions will occur with the Amero. This will be the currency among the three nations. And then, of course, if you want to look further to the world government, if you look at the cover of The Economist magazine, January 9, 1988, you'll see the Phoenix, it's called. By 2018, that'll be the new global currency, which is very symbolic, the Phoenix rising from the ashes and so on. Of course, it's very important to get the Middle East involved in this. Slobodan Milosevic was a stumbling block to get the linkage of Europe and trade going down to the Middle East, so he had to go, and our buddies, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, who we sided with against him in Macedonia and other places, were very convenient toward that end. And so you have to hold a carrot out to the Middle Eastern nations. There has to be conflict and chaos. You know, that's why Hezbollah is doing what they're doing. You can't just look at the Middle East conflict between Hezbollah and Israel as a local affair. Most people look at it, you have to look at it in terms of, if there's this global elite, how would this conflict, this chaos, serve their dialectical process? It'll wear the people down. You know, you have an attack and a counterattack. you can't possibly believe that the Israelis crushed Hezbollah to the extent they wanted to. No, no, no. The pressure was brought to bear by Solana and by the United States to back off, which they've done. And I've mentioned this map back in 1952 about when the New World Order world government comes about, what nations people will be policing other nations. And in the Middle East, according to this map, which also says the U.S. will be policing Yugoslavia, where we are now, and Kazakhstan, where we are now, and so on. It'll be Sri Lankans there. And for your listeners' information, 40% of the domestic servants in Lebanon today are Sri Lankans. I would encourage listeners to go to my News with Views column and look at the one, the recent one, Javier Solana and the End Times.
And you'll find that, certainly, www.newswithviews.com. Go over to the left side, you'll see the list of columnists, and click on Dr. Dennis Cuddy's articles and pull them down. They're well worthwhile reading. Dennis, thank you so very much for being up late this evening to share your research with our listeners out across America, indeed across the world.
Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. God bless, and we'll talk to you shortly.
You too.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I should have actually kept Dr. Cuddy on for a few more minutes while we're... in lieu of that, let me simply point out that there's so much about what happened on 9-1-1 we have not been told. And the great tragedy is that the average American does not have the time to do the research, and the other side is putting out all sorts of false stories. Now, the latest book, Without Precedent, by Thomas Keene and Lee Hamilton, Thomas Keene being the chairman of the commission, Lee Hamilton being the vice chairman of the commission, is well worthwhile reading, not so much for what it says, but what it doesn't say. Although one of the points that they make very clearly is that Condoleezza Rice told the commission that, you know, they could not do anything about Al-Qaeda. They wanted to do something about Al-Qaeda because of the bombing of the coal and certainly because of the bombing of our embassies. But the American people would not have accepted that there had to be an incident that would get the American people to go along with taking a more aggressive program. Now, what is so interesting then, of course, Donald Rumsfeld, when he testified, said that, you know, that there was a plan, that had been working on a plan to take out Al-Qaeda. They had been working on it since the Bush administration took office earlier in the year. But the plan had not been completed until the 10th of September. The plan was not completed until the day before the 9/11 attack. Isn't that convenient? And then the attack came, and within about 20 days, we had troops deployed in Afghanistan. Do you honestly believe that we were able to marshal the troops to go to war with Afghanistan in 20 days, having no idea what was going to happen? Or was this all, of course, planned ahead of time? And when have you go onto your computer, type in, and Google in, Building 7 videos, and watch Building 7 come down a few times, you realize this was a controlled demolition. I mean, after all, they tell you, was things were hitting the top of the building, embers from the Twin Towers. Well, if they hit the top of the building, why did the buildings, the base of the building, suddenly just go ahead and dissolve? And that's what happened. And you have the symmetrical fall of the building, obviously, very obviously, a controlled demolition of Building 7. I challenge you to go on the internet and to watch that building come down from various angles, and you realize the truth of what we're saying. If that is true, then everything you have been told about the war on terrorism is a lie. And I suggest you get the latest issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, published by the Council on Foreign Relations. Read the lead article on page 2. That's the September-October issue. And what do they say? Why there is almost no threat of Al-Qaeda in the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really do rely on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America trying to get the people to understand we're being manipulated into a third world war. And everything is being done to get the Muslims to hate America, and everything is being done to get the Americans to hate the Muslims. We're being manipulated, our minds are being molded, our tastes formed, our ideas are suggested by men we have never heard of. That's what Edward Bidet wrote back in 1928, but it's as true today as when he wrote it. Because there really are forces working behind the scenes. You'll want to get my August newsletter. We hope you'll subscribe. Otherwise, it'll be posted in about 2 weeks, or if you'd like to get a copy, why, we'll be glad to send you one free of charge. My August newsletter will explain to you why neither the Joint Intelligence Committee, which investigated 9-1-1 in the year 2002, or the 9-1-1 Commission, which investigated what happened in 2003 and published a report in 2004, why neither one of them got to the truth. And we will tell you something that nobody has picked up before. So if you'd like a copy of the newsletter that I think will convince you that there is a very definite reason why we're not getting the truth, why President Ahmadinejad went to talk to the Council on Foreign Relations on Wednesday, and yet most people have never heard of that, why, of course, well, you'll have to get the newsletter and read my explanation. And then, of course, we want to remind all of our listeners about the all-day seminar we're going to be having. It's going to be held here in the Aptos Sea Scout Golf Course on the 29th of October. And we do hope many of you are going to be able to come. We're going to have Constance Cumby. She's going to give two talks. Chris Pinto, we're giving him an hour and a half. He actually produced the film, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And we're going to have some other great talks, and I think it'll be an exciting day. More than that, you'll have an opportunity to get a lot of information and documentation and a lot of ideas. And I will tell you at the end of the day, if this coming meeting on the 29th of October is like past meetings, why, nobody wanted to go home. We have a terrible time to get people to leave, because everybody really, of course, wants to get the information. We've got to get the information out. A war with Iran will bankrupt America. I believe that's what it's designed to do. A war with America could well lead to an increased tempo of violence here in the United States, and inflaming every Muslim living in this country against this nation as they see the injustice of what's going on, and every Muslim in the world coming to hate America. But you can't have a war unless you've got hate, and there's an organized plan to create hatred, and please don't fall into that trap. You've got to be able to think beyond what they're trying to do as they manipulate our emotions. You've got to be able to think independently, because only then are you free. If you'd like, of course, information on our special seminar, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Get Dr. Cuddy's material. It's available free of charge on the Internet at newswithviews.com. And then, of course, if you should get my pamphlets, Foreknowledge 911, Foreknowledge 911, and you'll read what one of the most high-ranking CIA officials said. And he said off the record that when the dust finally clears after 911, the American people will realize that what happened was not a failure of intelligence. It was a triumph. When the dust finally clears, the American people will realize what happened was not a failure of intelligence. It was a triumph. And what you must understand, if that indeed is true, why hasn't anybody quoted that? And why haven't the committees, various committees, investigated the source of that quotation? It's available in a book we carry called See No Evil by Robert Baer. You need to get the book we carry called The Devil's Game that goes into the financing of this whole movement. And you need to read my newsletters, Foreknowledge 911. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival, because we're involved in a spiritual battle. There are powerful spiritual forces that are manipulating the United States and our leaders. And, well, of course, they're manipulating people throughout the world. And please pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, the guest for this hour is going to be Dr. Garth Nicholson. And Dr. Nicholson was a professor at MD Anderson Clinic in Texas, and but he has an amazing story, and we'll talk a little bit about it later, where he actually had to leave there for fear of his life. There had been murder attempts on both he and his wife because of the research they'd done going into the background of the Gulf War illness. And the experiments, the illegal experiments, have been carried out to people in the prisons in Texas, specifically at Huntsville. And then the epidemics of multiple sclerosis and anterior lateral sclerosis, and how the families and the guards and the families of this whole little community surrounding Huntsville, the prison, had become ill because of the illegal biological warfare experiments carried on the people. And that's a book we carry called Project Daylily. But we're going to start out the evening talking, I think, about the metabolic syndrome, which a doctor has done a great deal of work on. Of course, Dr. Nicholson works with the Institute on Molecular Medicine here in California, the IMMED.org, if you want to get to his website. The Institute of Molecular Medicine has given Dr. Nicholson the opportunity to continue his research, and we're going to be talking in the first part of the program about the metabolic syndrome, which is very, very important. And later on, we'll talk more about Project Daylily. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, let's get on into the metabolic syndrome, which a lot of people may not understand, and yet it affects, what, 20, 30% of the population?
22% of the adult population in the United States have this problem, and basically metabolic syndrome is really just a series of different abnormal signs and symptoms, which, if left unchecked, will proceed and progress to anything from type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, liver failure, kidney failure, and so on. And basically, we got involved in this because of one of the central defects in metabolic syndrome is the abnormal metabolism of lipids, and this leads to defects within cells in the mitochondria in the production of what are called reactive oxygen species, or oxidative stress. And these are chemicals which destroy the membranes of the mitochondria and also damage the DNA, our genetic code. And since the mitochondria provide the energy for the cell, this presents a real problem in that people are often fatigued and have other problems. But in the case of metabolic syndrome, the types of cells that are very susceptible are things like the beta cells in the pancreas. And, of course, these are the cells that produce insulin. And when this happens, people become have problems with insulin. Of course, this eventually leads to diabetes, type 2 diabetes, or adult onset diabetes. And there are a number of other problems that occur. Vascular inflammation is one of the biggest problems that occur with these excess reactive oxygen species. And we'll come back and discuss that, because this can lead to cardiovascular disease, arteriosclerosis, heart disease, and stroke.
But isn't, of course, a lot of this related to the fact that people already are overweight, and don't the abnormal fat cells begin to produce some of these problems?
Well, that's the central problem is obesity. And along with obesity goes along with hypertension, insulin resistance, abnormal lipoproteins in the blood, and hypercoagulants state or prothrombogenic state in the vascular system, and all these things go together with the metabolic syndrome.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson talking about the metabolic syndrome, and everybody needs to learn about this. Well, Dr. Nicholson, please pick up the story there.
Well, you know, we got involved in studying metabolic syndrome because we found that often people that have these unusual infections that we found from the Gulf War have this increase in these reactive oxygen species, which causes damage to the mitochondria, the little batteries inside our cells that provide the energy for our systems. And this leads to fatigue. In fact, the Gulf War illness that we studied is considered a fatiguing illness. And there are other illnesses like this, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome, and so on, that have as one of the central problems this defect in the mitochondria. And again, this is caused by, in this case, infection instead of by obesity and the problems associated with obesity that we were discussing with the metabolic syndrome. So these two are related in that they both have this excess production of reactive oxygen species, these very reactive free radicals that are formed as a byproduct of normal metabolism, but it gets out of hand in the structures that are damaged in the cell, cause a number of different changes in the cells, and eventually, as we were discussing in metabolic syndrome, cells that are very sensible, like in the pancreas, the cells that produce insulin are damaged, and then we no longer have the capacity to produce the insulin that we need, and in fact, we can't metabolize the carbohydrates adequately because we can't take them in and metabolize them. So then this eventually leads to a condition called type 2 diabetes. But in the vascular system, the same type of damage causes increased coagulation events and damage to the blood vessels, and this could eventually cause a breakaway of materials from the blood vessels and combined with platelets and so on, and actually forms blood clots, which can lead to stroke damage when it clogs vessels, for example, in our heart, can lead to heart failure and so on. So these are, they start out with, you know, a state which you can live with, which is metabolic syndrome. And again, I mentioned that 22% of the adult population has this problem in various degrees of severity. But if left unchecked, it can continue and eventually progress to type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, arteriosclerosis, and in some cases, liver, kidney, and other failure. And again, one of the underlying problems is this overproduction of these reactive oxygen, the damage. And to tie this into what we found from the Gulf War, the infections that we found in the Gulf War veterans caused some of these same problems. And then if we go back and look at that cohort of the population, and we see, well, what has happened to these Gulf War veterans that have had these infections? Well, in many cases, they've had premature death due to heart disease.
Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we're talking about the metabolic syndrome, and of course, they got interested in this because there was damage to the lipid membranes in people with this metabolic syndrome, as well as in people who have the Gulf War illness or chronic fatigue syndrome, and so there's a very definite alteration in lipid metabolism, although from different causes within the metabolic syndrome. It seems that they're abnormal oxidation, and this is why the antioxidants, we're talking about vitamin C and vitamin E and other products, certainly the more natural products, are so beneficial, you know, as far as cutting down this abnormal oxygen radicals. But please pick up the story there.
As you just said, one of the ways to counter this problem is to counter the reactive oxygen species with antioxidants. So this is a well-known approach. Unfortunately, this doesn't repair the damage that's been done. It can help alleviate the potential future damage. So we've come up with another approach to repair some of the damage that's been done in the major targets of damage are the membranes, the lipid membranes. So the approach that we use is called lipid replacement therapy, where we actually have a dietary form of lipids, and these are beneficial lipids. These are not harmful lipids. These are mostly membrane lipids that are immediately incorporated into the membranes and help essentially plug the holes where the oxidative lipids have caused leakage in the membranes. And although that's an oversimplification, I think for purposes of for our purposes, it's certainly adequate to think of it in those terms. And this then makes the membranes less leaky, and now they can perform function in terms of oxidative phosphorylation, and they could produce the energy that's needed. And so we've seen this in Gulf War illness patients and chronic fatigue syndrome patients in a variety of different conditions, and also now in metabolic syndrome, where once the membranes are repaired, then there's less reactive oxygen species being produced, and the oxidative phosphorylation can occur naturally, and it's under control like it should be, and energy is being generated, and the cells can then recover. This is the approach that we're using with diet, with antioxidants, and with lipid replacement therapy to help repair some of the damage that's been done to people that have this not only metabolic syndrome, but also have these unusual infections.
Well, of these people that have the unusual infections, you've talked about the mycoplasma and Berriella and Brucella and all of these other chronic chlamydia, these chronic infections that are plaguing so many of our people now. Do you then use this this lipid replacement in addition to antibiotics? Do you use both together?
Yes, we do. In fact, we use the antioxidants and the lipid replacement therapy as part of the regimen of treating these infections. And all of these infections that we've studied have in common is that they're intracellular bacterial infections. That is, they're little bacteria that they get inside our cells and cause metabolic problems inside the cells. And in many cases, some of the same types of problems that obesity causes. There's an increase in free fatty acids, and there's an increase in mitochondrial membrane damage due to this reactive oxygen species or excess oxidative stress because of the infection present inside the cell. And without going into a lot of biochemical detail on it, I think it's only really important to know that when you have these infections, damage will occur, and this damage, for example, if the infection is in the heart, can cause major vascular problems and inflammation of the heart. And as we found in the Gulf War veterans that came back that had these infections, they had enlarged hearts, inflamed blood vessels, there were clots forming in the vessels, and we had a very high incidence of heart disease and heart attack and heart failure, coronary arrest, in under 25-year-old veterans. And that's absolutely amazing for somebody who's less than 25 years of age to have these problems. And so because of this, there was a tremendous loss of heart function in these very young veterans. So the first thing to do was to treat the infection, and antibiotics are used primarily. But then we needed to somehow repair the damage that had been done, and that's where the antioxidants and the lipid replacement therapy came in to help these people regenerate some of the damaged membranes and other structures inside the cells that are so important in their function. And we managed to see some cases where they were down to 20% heart function and increased slowly back to about 60% heart function, at least to the point where they could go home and lead a semi-normal life again and actually hold down jobs and so on and so forth. So in the cases where we were involved in, everybody recovered. In the cases where we weren't involved in, unfortunately, everybody died. And so this was one of the byproducts of what happened in the Gulf War. And I think for the remainder of our topic, we can get into where did these infections come from in the first place? And how did our veterans get these infections? And, you know, there's a long story about this, and it goes back to really the military vaccines that were conceived really going back before World War II, back to World War I. And the major strategies in the U.S. Armed Forces to fight infection has been the development of vaccines to stimulate our immune systems to fight the infectious agents and destroy them. And in many cases, this has been quite successful, but in some cases, the vaccines that were used actually contributed to the problem, and we've seen that in the first Gulf War and in part in the second Gulf War as well, is that some of the military vaccines are just inadequate and they've caused more problems than they've solved. And in the cases of the first Gulf War, there are several epidemiological studies that point to the vaccines given during deployment as the major source of Gulf War illness. They set these young veterans up for conditions of infection, conditions of chemical damage, and so on and so forth. And it was really unnecessary, I think, if we'd done our homework correctly, if we'd prepared our armed forces correctly, this wouldn't have happened. But since it did happen, we need to correct the problem and not go back and repeat history again. And so that's one of the purposes of putting out information like this, is to push the armed forces and to push our government into preventing this from occurring again, so that history doesn't repeat itself. And they've done sort of a semi-good job of this. They've replaced some of the vaccines, and hopefully they've stopped using some of the experimental vaccines. But it's very difficult, I think, to stop them from experimenting on military personnel. And this is a book, Project Daylily, that my wife and I wrote to kind of expose this problem for what it is. It's a very deadly problem that's really an outgrowth from Operation Paperclip at the end of World War II, when we recovered many of the Nazi scientists and engineers and brought them back to the United States. And many of these were involved in chemical and biological warfare, and we put them to work on our own laboratories and so on. And some of the legacy of what we've now faced from the Gulf War actually has its origin in Eastern Europe, when the Eiffarben Company and their scientists and engineers were trying to develop new biological weapons and test them. And some of these weapons were brought back and refined further, and we think that one of the weapons that we discovered, the mycoplasma, which had been modified, was one of these weapons that was brought back and developed further as an incapacitating biological warfare agent. And what this means is it was developed to not to kill, but to incapacitate not only soldiers, but civilians, to the point where they can't function, and they require many more people to help them and take care of them, and therefore causing and creating havoc in not only civilian, but military populations. And so once you have weapons like this and develop them, there's the urge to test them. And this is what the book Project Daylily is all about. How do we test these weapons? Well, it turns out in the United States there are two primary ways that new weapons are tested. They're tested on prisoners in our prison system, and they're tested on military recruits. And Project Daylily covers both of these topics, because we inadvertently stumbled upon this when we were trying to help not only our stepdaughter and her colleagues who were sick from Gulf War illness, but then the prisoners and the prison guards and their family members had become sick in the state of Texas, and we didn't know that they were coming down with essentially Gulf War illness until after the Gulf War, until some of our studies were made popular in the local press. And the prison guards and their family members came forward to us and said, you know, that looks a lot like what we're calling the mystery illness that so many of us have in this case in Texas. And when we started to look into this, we found that not only did we find the same infections that we found in the Gulf War veterans, but there were a lot of things going on in the prison system which were totally unregulated and totally without medical or scientific principle, in that these prisoners are being used as guinea pigs without full informed consent.
In total violation, of course, of the Geneva Accord and Geneva Convention.
Well, there were so many violations of law, and both national and international law, it's hard to know where to start. But the people that have done this need to be held accountable, and I think they need to pay for their crimes against humanity.
And, but, of course, the thing is, that is where you and your wife came under real attack, and really why the people started dying. And I understand, when we get back, we can talk a little bit more about that, but certainly the man who was your superior there at MB Anderson, it was a Army colonel or Air Force colonel, and he was murdered shortly after he told you he was going to actually blow the whistle on it?
That's correct, and we can get back and discuss that.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here. At Radio Liberty. Ladies and gentlemen, we carry the book Project Daylily. It's factual, written as fiction. You'll want to read it. Well, why did you pick up the story there, Garth?
Well, this is actually the part of the story of Project Daylily, which is our personal story. And it's not only based on a true story, these are true events, and the only thing that has really been changed are the names and the places in the book. And some of the dialogue we've had to reconstruct, particularly if we weren't present, but we had a mole that was present that relayed what happened. And so Project Daylily puts together this saga of ours to uncover the truth about what happened, not only in Operation Desert Storm to our veterans, but what happened in the prison system with so many prisoners and in-prison guards and their family members becoming sick and dying. And let's sort of get back to the question of using prisoners as guinea pigs for the testing of essentially military weapons. And we know this took place in Texas because some of the families that were involved in this had lost loved ones, either in the prison system or because they were employees of the Texas Department of Corrections, actually dug up the documents that prove that they were doing illegal experimentation with the approval of the prison board in selected prisons in Texas. And these were the prisons where all the illness was found in Texas. And they were in a situation where prisoners were dying, scores of prisoners each week were dying. And these prisoners, after they died, were actually taken to a U.S. Army base in Texas where they were autopsied, instead of, by law, going to the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, where they should have gone to be autopsied. And I know that because one of my students became one of the assistant directors of the autopsy service at that branch of the University of Texas. And unfortunately, he's dead now, along with two other of my students and other colleagues of mine that died under very suspicious circumstances. And this goes back to what you mentioned before. One of my superiors, Dr. Fred Conrad, who was the vice president of patient care at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, was shot in the back of the head in his office one morning. And that same morning I walked in with him, actually, and he told me that he was going to put a stop to these prison experiments. And unfortunately, they put a stop to him. But this is not the only person who died under very suspicious circumstances, and I wouldn't be surprised if... Other different diseases, rheumatic illnesses, heart disease, and so on and so forth. Very unusual, particularly when you have some 60 or 70 cases of multiple sclerosis in a little town of less than 30,000, and 43 cases of Lou Gehrig's disease, four on the same block that are not necessarily genetically related. But what was related in all these people that got sick, we found in these little towns, was they all either worked in the prison system or a family member worked in the prison system. And that's...
Please hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment, guys. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Nicholson's just talking about the fact that, you know, here in this little town of about 30,000 people, Huntsville, adjacent to the Huntsville prison, why, of course, there's just so many people, are ill with Lou Gehrig's disease and multiple sclerosis and all these other diseases, and the one common denominator was either they worked in the prison or they had a family member who worked in the prison, and now the disease is spreading in the general community. I mean, they call for the Centers for Disease Control, and apparently, didn't they send in a team there, and they just didn't find anything at all?
Well, not only that, they first contacted the State Department of Public Health, and they came in to do a study, and after a six-month study or whatever, they issued a report saying that they couldn't find it in the water. Well, the people that were sick were telling them it's the prisons, not the water. But they purposely avoided any contact or any testing in the prison system and concentrated on the water source. And so That was the report. The water was clean and there was no problem with the water. But these people were being exposed to these airborne infections in the prisons and bringing them home into the community, and that's where people were getting sick, not from the water. So the whole thing was just a total cover-up, and the investigations were a total sham. In fact, they were designed to not find the truth and not find anything. They were designed to really probe and see what was going on and to give a reason for what was happening. But, you know, when you have something like Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or ALS, that has an incidence of something like 1 in 100,000, and you have a little town of 30,000 where there's some 40 people who are sick with this unusual neurodegenerative disease, that you begin to wonder. And when we started studying these people, every one of them had this Mycoplasma fermentans. And this is a very unusual infection which can invade the central nervous system. And when it gets in your brain, it causes cell death. And it causes many of the problems that we were mentioning at the beginning of the talk, and the eruption of these reactive oxygen species, which eventually causes a phenomenon called apoptosis or programmed cell death. And when it occurs in the brain, of course, this is really quite a problem, and you end up with neurodegeneration in various areas of the brain. You simply die cell by cell, and then you become incapacitated. And eventually with ALS, it's a very horrible disease and a very horrible death, where you virtually lose control over your muscles and eventually lose the ability to swallow and have problems breathing and so on. So these are very, very damaging types of illnesses once they get loose, and particularly if they've gone untreated. And they were just avoiding treating them. They were denying that these had anything to do with an infectious process. And because of that, you know, these people did not receive the proper care, and eventually most of them died. The ones that we helped, however, survived. And most of these cases, later on, they denied that they did have, for example, ALS or MS, but we knew from the medical records that that wasn't true. These patients had made copies of their medical records, and they'd been properly worked up and diagnosed, for example, at Baylor College of Medicine and in the Department of Neurology. And so they really did have the diagnosis of these unusual neurodegenerative diseases. But what wasn't recognized at the time, and is still not recognized in the medical fields, particularly the medical field of neurology, is that these chronic intracellular bacterial infections may play a very important role in these diseases. And now let's go to the Gulf War. The first Gulf War, there's the admission finally that ALS cases are way, way in excess of what they should have been in the veterans of the first Gulf War. And in fact, we've done a study which we published in a neurologic journal showing that 100% of these cases had this unusual bacterial infection, Mycoplasma fermentans.
But now, isn't that really genetically engineered? Aren't there some abnormal genes on that would not ordinarily be there?
There are. I mean, we found some unusual genes. For example, in about half of the military cases that we looked at, there was the HIV-1 envelope gene, and this is a gene from the AIDS virus that is used to target the virus to the immune cells. And so one of the things that happens in these patients is their immune systems are degraded very quickly, and we think that that was one of the reasons for putting this insert into the mycoplasma.
All right, fine. Of course, you know, the implications of this really are frightening, that they would actually create these new and terrible diseases. And then, of course, they would experiment not only certainly on our prisoners without their consent, but also on American servicemen. That, of course, is rather frightening, especially if you look at the number of servicemen from the first Gulf War who are ill today. And, of course, if you look at the Veterans Administration figures, which I have, why an awful lot of them have died. A significant number of them have died. Previously young, healthy, vibrant men. Anybody would like to see those figures? We have them. How could this be going on and nobody's talking about it? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. And let me just comment that if you read the book by Zygmunt Brzezinski, The Between Two Ages, it was written in 1970. In the footnote at the bottom of one of the pages, he talks about, quoting an expert who says, you know, by the year 2018, we'll be able to create storms and droughts and new chronic diseases to disable the enemy. We'll be able to create new chronic diseases to be able to disable the enemy. Well, if you have those new diseases you've created, you got to try them out to make sure they work. And the frightening thing is it would appear that they have created these diseases, and they are trying them out to see if they work. And an awful lot of American soldiers and prisoners, are, of course, have paid with their lives. So pick the story up there, Dr. Nicholson.
Well, we do know that in at least 40 to 45% of the Gulf War illness cases, that this unusual mycoplasma is involved. And we've done the testing. We've looked at over 1,600 patients. We've published our results. Three other laboratories have duplicated our results. So we know that these are real. And now, what impact does this have on the civilian communities, besides these individuals coming home and spreading their illness to their immediate family members? And let me just spend just a few minutes on that, because we studied the families. In fact, I think we're the only research group that has actually done any comprehensive studies on the immediate family members of Gulf War veterans with these infections. These are airborne infections, so they do have the potential to spread in a community, but they are not like influenza virus. They do not spread quickly. They spread very slowly. And it's insidious, because in the immediate family members, first the spouses became sick, and often they were diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome.
Hold that thought right there. Oh, go right ahead. I'm sorry. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. And when the children became involved, because they're growing so rapidly, they often had the learning and behavior disabilities, things that we call... There are several different infections in the civilian group, some of which were very similar types, some of which were different. But the commonality, I think, was that these infections seem to be involved so often in these chronic disorders. And not only that, in the rheumatic illnesses, rheumatoid arthritis, sarcoidosis, so on and so forth, Over half the cases also showed the presence of these mycoplasmal infections. But again, the civilian showed several different types of species and different types of infections, whereas in the military families, primarily one infection relating back to the Gulf War and relating back to the multiple military vaccines that these veterans received during deployment.
In the civilian population, why do you think that they have all these infections? You mentioned the frequency of herpes simplex 6, or herpes virus 6. Do you think it's perhaps sexual promiscuity? Do you think that perhaps dental technicians are more prone to get that simply because they're close to the saliva and other things? Why are we seeing so much of this chronic fatigue syndrome and this chronic fibromyalgia, which seem to go together, in the general population?
Well, number one, these are airborne infections. Although they're not very contagious, they can be passed in close quarters. And this is why, for example, air crews were often in one air crew. If one person came down with these infections, others as well. And so we work with the Airline Pilots Association with some of the problems that they've had. In the schools, for example, when children get it, they can pass it to other children. And the transmission within family members, spouses, for example, can get it either by airborne or fluid transmission to their children. It's primarily an airborne transmission. So they can be slowly passed, and that's why families are such high risk when we see this type of incidence. In fact, epidemiological studies have been done showing the linkage with families with these type of chronic conditions, that they're much more prevalent within families where the disease is present than in families where the disease is not present. That is, the sporadic cases, you do see them, but often they're linked to other cases as well. So we do know that there is an ability to transmit this type of illness to somebody else. But they won't necessarily come down with exactly the same disease. And this is the interesting part where genetics plays a role. In some cases, most of the complaints may be more like rheumatoid arthritis, whereas in another individual, most of the complaints might be gastrointestinal, inflammatory bowel syndrome, and so on. And in another patient, neurological, short-term memory loss, brain fog, severe headaches, other types of problems. So it seems to, these infections seem to attack your weak point. And people that are, weaker in terms of, let's say, their immune system and their gastrointestinal system will be much more prone to have gastrointestinal problems and difficulties there. That's one of the hard difficulties or the hard points that we've had to learn and repeat to physicians who see this, that don't just assume that because there's one type of infection, you're going to get one type of disease. That's the fallacy. And, as you have done, I taught medical school for 25 years or more, and there was kind of the thinking that, if you have one virus like poliovirus, you're going to get polio. But with these chronic infections, that's not true at all. You often get mixtures of different infections, and instead of getting one specific disease, you end up with a variety of syndromes. So these are disease-like conditions, but they can't be pinned down on the basis of signs and symptoms as a particular disease. And this is why things like chronic fatigue syndrome have so many of these non-specific signs and symptoms. We can't really pin it down as to a specific cause, whether it be environmental exposure, infection, or whatever, because they have some of these common problems. And one of these I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, which is the stimulation of reactive oxygen species, excess reactive oxygen species, excess oxidative damage to the mitochondria. This is one of the common themes that we find in all fatiguing illnesses, damaged mitochondria. And so this presents us now with a way to reverse this. And this is what we've been trying to do with diet, with antioxidants, with lipid replacement therapy, and in the case where the infections are involved, with antibiotics or antivirals to subdue the infection and to suppress it as much as we can. And so our whole approach to trying to solve these different illnesses involve a variety of different approaches. There's no simple answer. There's no simple treatment involved. You've got to work on everything from diet and lifestyle and obesity problems and drug use and so on and so forth, because all these play a role. And that's what makes these illnesses so intriguing and so difficult.
In the past, you mentioned that this product called Propax, which we've actually contacted the manufacturer of that, you mentioned that this seemed to give fairly good results as far as the chronic fatiguing illnesses. How effective is this Propax, which is a lipid replacement and antioxidant therapy?
Well, we've done four clinical trials on Propax and the lipid replacement active ingredient, which is called NT factor. And all of these trials yielded very interesting and significant results. And we did one trial with aged individuals that were complaining of fatigue all the time. We did another trial with chronic fatigue syndrome patients and fibromyalgia patients and so on. All these trials showed that if we used lipid replacement therapy, diet, and antioxidants, that we could reverse this problem of fatigue in these patients. And we found, on the average, about a 40% reduction in fatigue using a number of different tests like the Piper fatigue scale and so on. We published these results, and a lot of people have been very interested in our findings now, because these are things that you can buy over the counter. This is not something that you have to go to a physician and have a prescription. Many of our approaches are self-help approaches, and we provide information, so people contact me at the Institute for Molecular Medicine. Just go to our website, www.immed.org. They can find out information. They can also send me an email. I'll be glad to send them the relevant publications and so on. Okay. Or they can buy the book Project Daylily, and this explains some of the thinking behind finding the root cause of some of these conditions like Gulf War illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, rheumatoid arthritis, and how the infections were discovered in this case, and how they can be treated as well. And so we've tried to provide information in a number of different ways by writing a book that people could read as a thriller, medical thriller story. And by the way, we went through some scrapes in that book, which people find awfully interesting, and they wonder why we're still alive. And
I'm glad you are.
And sometimes I wonder myself, but if it, you know, wasn't for the grace of God, we wouldn't be here. And I think that there was a reason why we survived, and we were spared because we have to tell this story. We have to help other people who come down with this illness and these illnesses, these various conditions, to try and help them overcome these problems.
Well, now you mentioned, of course, the website, which is immed.org. That's like immediate, it's immed.org. You mentioned people could send you an email. How would they get in touch with you by email?
Well, they can find my email address on the website.
All right, fine. So you go to the website, immed.org, and you will find the email address there. And then if you'd like more information from Dr. Nicholson, you know, what are the problems that people who have these diseases, and of course they overlap with Lyme disease and others, is that they have a hard time finding a physician who will treat them, and the physicians who are willing to treat them and give them chronic, or long-term use of antibiotics, usually come under tremendous pressure from the medical boards. Why would that be? I would think they'd be anxious to have these tragic people treated.
Well, again, this goes into, why were we targeted as well, and Lyme disease is one of the issues that we deal with on our website, and every day I have people contacting me that have Lyme disease. Lyme disease is another one of these conditions which involves multiple chronic infections, and the mycoplasma is one of the most prominent co-infection with the Lyme Borrelia. So it's something that I've spoken on in several international meetings in the last year where the topic was exclusively Lyme disease, because these types of infections are so important in causing disease that we need to know about them, and we need to know how to treat them. And we also need to protect the physicians who take the patients that have things like Lyme disease and treat them adequately, because they're under fire, just like we've been under fire for years now. For us, I guess we're more resistant to it in a way because we've been under fire for so long, but in the case of the community physicians out there that are trying to help, trying to diagnose and treat things like Lyme disease and mycoplasmal infections when they occur in a variety of different medical conditions, it's very difficult for them. It's much easier to just ignore it and pretend it's not a problem. It's much more difficult if they really look at the research literature and look at the clinical trials and so on and decide, look, there is something here. These patients need to be properly diagnosed and properly treated. But then they come under scrutiny from the medical boards. And I don't know where all the pressure is coming from, but I do know that there is a bit more or less a national, I don't know if it's an organization or what, that puts out information very quietly, very specifically to medical boards and so on. And so there must be a reason like that why physicians are targeted for treating these patients that come to them.
And because these patients really do need therapy. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Dr. Nicholson, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Dr. Nicholson has published well over 600 peer-reviewed articles. How many peer-reviewed articles do you have in the literature now?
Well, it's about 600 now, and I have served on 20 editorial boards of medical and scientific journals, and I was the editor of at least three of these different journals. I've passed most of my editorial duties off to things like my students now, and are trying to concentrate more on trying to provide information, medical information, particularly on these chronic infections to people that suffer so much because of them.
And, of course, we're talking about 2 million people with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. They sort of blend into one another. 1 million people with Lyme disease. And then you've actually talked about how many of the children with autism seem to have these chronic infections as well. What's that all about?
Well, you know, we got involved in that from the Gulf War veterans' family members. The children were coming down with autistic spectrum disorders, and this happened after a veteran returned from the Gulf with this unusual mycoplasma, and it spread to the family members. So we started looking in more detail at the civilian families that have autism and Asperger's syndrome and other autistic spectrum disorders, which are, again, learning and behavior disorders in these young students. And we found a lot of infections. Over half the patients that we looked at had mycoplasmal infections. There was another subset that had other types of infections, viral infections, for example. And so we now think that the autistic spectrum disorders involve infections as well as chemicals and heavy metals and some of the more traditional things that people have looked at. So this triad of environmental exposure, infection, heavy metal, and so on, this is really important for a variety of chronic illnesses, and it may underlie most of the chronic illnesses that we see clinically. And so we need to understand how our systems are damaged by these different contaminants or infections, and what can we do about it. And so that's primarily what we've tried to do, is to provide information to people that have these problems, but they have nowhere to go for help. And I think that's one of the sad things in our medical system today, is that in terms of these chronic illnesses, often people just have nowhere to go to get help.
Well, do you think that these children with autism, and many of them, of course, have significantly high levels of mercury within them, do you think that the mercury interferes with the immune response, and that's why they have a predilection to the infections, or what's the relationship there?
Well, we don't know the exact relationship, but we do know that both the infections, in the case of the heavy metals, can damage the immune system. They can also cause neurologic problems, because in the developing brain is very sensitive, for example, to both infections and heavy metals and chemicals as well. So this triad, as I was mentioning, of insults to these developing young people do cause tremendous problems, and they can affect them for the rest of their lives. So we've been trying to get the information out. I've been speaking at a number of autism workshops. I have to go to one this fall to try and get the information out to the parents. The parents have been very receptive to this. The medical professional, a little less receptive in a way, because they have their own axe to grind, I guess. But the parents are usually very quick to pick up on this, because they see the similarities and they see the problems. And also we've had a really quite remarkable good luck in suggesting therapies to these young young patients with problems, learning and behavior disability problems.
Well, of course, is it important to try to get rid of the mercury? And then, of course, do they need antibiotic treatment? What sort of combined treatment would it be? Would it be certainly this Propax or other lipid therapy along with antioxidants? How would you approach a child with, of course, autism and these learning disabilities?
Well, the first thing is evaluation and to find out what types of contaminants they have, what types of heavy metals, what types of infections, if they have chemical exposures, what types of chemicals they may have been exposed to. And then, of course, there's quite a regimen of diet, of treatment, of antioxidant therapy, lipid replacement therapy, and so on. And we'd be glad to provide information on that to anyone who's interested.
All right, fine. Well, I guess it's been Dr. Garth Nicholson, and certainly his website, immed.org. That's www.immed.org. And we have literally millions of people with these chronic diseases, and I fear that number will grow and continue to grow until we get to the bottom of who it is who's been contaminating and damaging our people and children. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dr. Nicholson, you got 3 minutes to finish up the program.
Well, again, I want to go back to our book Project Daylily. I think people would be surprised at the amount of information that's contained. Although it's written as a medical thriller and tells the story of my wife and I and how we escaped a certain death at the hands of people who were performing this illegal experimentation on prisoners and military recruits and so on. And it also explains in there how these types of infections are involved in a variety of different chronic illnesses that we see today in our population. But beyond that, beyond Project Daylily, people have contacted us from all over the world for information about chronic diseases, chronic illnesses, how these can be identified, how they can be treated, and particularly the self-help aspect of it. What can we do ourselves in terms of diet, in terms of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, lipid replacement therapy, other things that we can do ourselves, immune enhancement products and so on, to prevent this from occurring, to treat it if it occurs, and how can we help our loved ones essentially that have broken bodies because of these different illnesses and infections.
And I think this is really so vitally important that unfortunately, when you go to the doctor, he is not capable of making the diagnosis because these chronic infections are very, very difficult to evaluate. You really need almost special types of lab equipment to do that, don't you?
Well, that's correct. I mean, it's very difficult to find these infections because they hide so deep inside our cells, and so they're highly sophisticated molecular techniques that have been developed to find them. In some cases, not even then are we able to find them because we have to work with things like blood samples and we have to work with the white cells in the blood and hope that the white cells have picked up enough of the infection so that we can find it with these sensitive molecular techniques. And we've been involved in developing those. We did that after the first Gulf War, and we've continued to do that. And there are laboratories around the country and other places of the world that can do this, and people contact me on a daily basis for information on how to find these laboratories and how to get blood samples to them for testing and so on. So that's an important aspect of it, because without a positive test result, most physicians just will refuse to even consider that this is a problem, because they just don't to think that way. They don't think like we think, that's for sure.
And of course, the thing is you have to have the facilities to do these very, very sophisticated tests, and you need to know where the laboratories are that can do it. There aren't that many. Well, I guess it's been Dr. Garth Nicholson. His book, Project Daylily, you want to get it, you want to read it. And actually, as a physician, I learned a tremendous amount. And you will begin to get into this whole incredible story. Garth, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on your program again.
Good night. God bless you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you've enjoyed our interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson. And basically, if you'd like to get his book, Project Daylily, I will tell you it is a thriller. It's hard to actually put down. I got him one of the original drafts of it. It's a very fairly lengthy book, but it is a fast-moving adventure story. Written like a Tom Clancy or Michael Crichton mystery, but unfortunately, it's true. And there really are evil and wicked people out there. And I've, as I said, I've actually interviewed some of the people he talks about, so I know the story is true, and I know many of the people he's referring to, although many times the names have been changed. But, of course, they're concealing the guilty. Now, we have a terrible problem, ladies and gentlemen, because there really are people who have created terrible diseases, and they're experimenting on the American people, and that they are working on new diseases they may unleash upon the American people, and the average individual says that couldn't be true. Well, you really need to go back and to read, and we have the full text of the testimony of Dr. David MacArthur back in 1969 before the House Appropriations Committee, where he asked for $10 million to create a new disease for which there will be no immune response from the human body. And he wants $10 million to produce it, even though many people warned this would be a new means of mass killing, and he got his money, and 10 years later, why, we had our first cases of AIDS. 1979, we didn't recognize it till it was 1981. And now, so far, 20 to 30 million people have died. We have lost over 500,000 Americans, another million are infected or more. Now, suddenly the CDC is coming out and recommending every patient be tested for this disease. We've recommended that in 1986, 20 years ago, and we were laughed at and ridiculed, and yet that's exactly what they're recommending today. Oh, everybody should be tested. This should be treated like every other disease. If you haven't read my book, The AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, you need to get it and read it. You need to get Dr. Nicholson's book, Project Daylily. We still carry Dr. Horowitz's book, Emerging Viruses, that goes into the actual production of the AIDS virus. And, of course, we cover that in my book, pardon me, in my talk, Planned Population Reduction, which is available either in DVD or in VHS. It's almost 2.5 hours the talk we gave, if you can stand to hear me talk for 2.5 hours. AIDS is simply part of the overall worldwide population control program. If you'd like to get the Project Daylily or the other items I've mentioned, Planned Population Reduction, AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, or Emerging Viruses, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Remember, we are having an all-day seminar. It's on the 29th of October. That's the 29th of October. Right here in the Monterey Bay area, we're bringing in speakers from across the country. I think it's going to be a great meeting, and we do hope that you'll be able to come. Again, if you'd like to make reservations for this, we have to know if you're going to be here, because we're serving lunch. And, of course, if you want to be getting rooms, why, you can get them for the next week at a reduced cost in the area. If you're coming from outside, the number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I think you'll find it'll be a fascinating program. Certainly, we've been very pleased with the programs in the past, and I think that the people who've been here in the past were pleased. I know that it seems at the end of the day why nobody wants to go home. So, anyway, we hope you'll get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read that. Because what is behind what's going on? Why, ladies and gentlemen, there's organized evil out there. There are people who look at the world entirely differently than you and I. They have no concern about the loss of human lives, and they're quite willing to sacrifice individual lives, or hundreds of lives, or thousands of lives, or millions of lives, or perhaps even billions of lives. There really are people who think there are too many people in the world and we're going to have to do away with them. If you don't believe that, you need to get my population control material. You can get it on our website of RadioLiberty.com, the Population Control Agenda. Pray for America. Pray for revival, because we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization.
Afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it is. Yes, it is. It is Friday. It is the 22nd of September, 2006. And I know that there are legions of folks out there that were